never left my country, nor have I ceded any part of it.
Let's talk. Triple A's flagship program that continues to elevate the diverse voices of First Nations people across the country. Centered around the unceded sovereignty of First Nations people in this country, honouring the history with a solutions-based focus on the future. With your host, Pomeroy journalist, Danny Tierce Johnson.
Yama, hello and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Danny Tierce Johnson, Pomeroy journalist from Moree in New South Wales. I'd like to start the show by acknowledging country. I acknowledge the traditional owners from the lands that we broadcast from, the Cubby Cubby people, and I extend that greeting all across this beautiful Black Nation today to wherever you're listening, your elders past and present. I'm at the AATSA Summit 2022 up here on the Sunshine Coast in Cubby Cubby country, and it's just been a beautiful couple of days talking to mob from all over the country, all things AATSAs. Today on our show, I've been looking forward to having a chat with this guest for quite a while now. I met him a few years back and always have a lot of respect for this man, but Mr. Kato Miwa. So he's the chair of the National Native Title Council, and he's also here as the First Nations Protection Heritage Alliance from Western Australia. Brother Kato, how are you?
Hey, good. Yeah, how are you?
You look a bit different, brother, I've got to say. Last time I seen you, you had dreadlocks and a big beard.
Yeah. No, going through another stage and... Hair change.
At least you've got some, brother. Jeez. I was actually looking at you yesterday and I was like, I'm sure I know that man. And then I just clicked, oh, it's Kato. He's had a haircut.
Yeah. That's going on with
everyone. We're always checking each other out, aren't we?
Yeah.
Hey, brother, tell me what you're doing here at the AATSA Summit.
Yeah, well.
1,000 delegates here from all over, and you know, you wear a couple of hats here at this conference, so can you tell us a bit about what you do, brother?
Yeah, no, sure. But I'll start just by acknowledging Gubbi Gubbi people and all the other nations around Australia. Privileged to be having a voice to share ideas. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so we're at the IATSIS Summit 2022. We've got mobs from all over the country here, and it's basically in some way like a festival of ideas. It's basically,
yeah, it is, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And you know, people are coming, sharing their knowledge and their insights, and it's so great to see, you know, these emerging powerful sort of intellectual leaders.
I found it very inspirational in that sense, the intellect here. And I love what you call it, a festival of ideas, because it really is that. It's just not a summit. It's sort of, you know, we've got mob, young, middle-aged and old coming together from all over the country and sharing this powerful, powerful knowledge that they have. It's a lot to take in, but it's so great to take it in.
Well, see, we're in exciting times. You know, this is like the 30-year anniversary of the Mabo decision.
Yep.
In the sessions that are going on, I'm going back, you know, you've got a lot of the elders in the room, people who have campaigned and fought under Whitlam and even before Whitlam's time.
Yep, yeah.
And they're all sharing their insights. And, you know, the last 30, 40 years has been pretty tough, but we've also made a lot of progress.
Yeah.
And it's really good to be actually in a space like this, looking at empowered First Nations people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are empowered, who have confidence, great self-esteem, and they're basically stepping forward and taking on leadership roles at a national level.
Yeah, it's just so great to see. And this summit sort of, you know, is a microscope for that change, you know. Before we get into the chat about your work and what you're over here for, can I get your thoughts on the federal election 2022? I know you've been heavily involved in politics. You've had run a couple of times yourself. But what's your thought? I mean, there's a sense of hope, a new hope now that we can have a new dialogue with the Albanese government.
Well, it looks like it. He set the tone early on.
I just wonder what your thoughts on it, and particularly over in Western Australia where you come from.
Well, I mean, we're particularly excited. There's a larger representation of our mob in Parliament, so that's great. And I think Northern Territory is almost 100% Indigenous representation. There are different views coming through the representation,
yep.
Which is normal, because we've you know, for too long we've been chucked into a box and told you've got to have one particular view, but part of this festival of ideas is to be able to put these things out there and to argue and put your points of view across.
Yep.
So that's, I think that's a great change. We're seeing the Prime Minister is setting the tone for what he sees as the, you know, the way the relationship needs to evolve. And then, of course, we've got in Linda Burney, probably one of the most, well, not wanting to put too much pressure on her, but possibly one of the most effective, you know, Aboriginal Affairs Ministers we're probably ever going to have.
Yeah.
You know, I can't see anyone in caucus standing up and telling Linda Burney what's what about Aboriginal Affairs or Indigenous Affairs.
Yeah, that's right. She's a very strong and staunch woman, Linda Burney, so we wish her all the best in that chair, because it is can be a bit of a double-edged sword, you know, taking
sometimes
on that role.
A poison chalice, yes, is the other word.
Yes.
And it's largely because, and this is a thing right across the board, whether it's in your workplace, in, you know, a school, a university, whatever, police force, if you're an Aboriginal person employed in there, they look to you to get input and ideas, but they never support you or give you the resources to be able to make that change happen.
Ooh.
And that's the thing I think we need to really push back on and say, if you want our contribution in these circumstances, you've really got to resource it.
Yeah. A lot of hyenas out there picking our knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, and that's very exhausting in itself. So what are you doing at the summit here? You've got the First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance from WA, but you're also the chair of the National Native Title Council.
Yes.
So you got a? Have you got a talk on or?
Yeah. Apparently, I've got four talks on.
Oh. Lucky I got you when I did then.
Yeah. No, I'm participating throughout in various forms. One in my personal capacity, I'm up as a native title holder with our former lawyer, who's now the lawyer operating in this country with WW people.
Ooh.
But he was the lawyer that represented my mob in the Tjiwal native title determination. Mm-hmm. One of the rights we secured recognition for, because it's a coexisting native title determination, apart from a small area of exclusive possession. One of the rights we had was the right to access, take and use resources for any purposes. Now, as a lot of mob know, the settler state tries to, economic marginalisation is the strongest tool they have in their cupboard to stop us from determining our own futures.
Yep.
And so this right is an important native title right, and it really needs to be defined by us as to what it means to be able to access, take and use resources on our land for any purposes.
Ooh.
So that's one of the talks that I'll be doing in my personal capacity.
Yep.
But the other stuff that I'm doing is here with the, well, National Native Title Council, which, you know, is always on recruitment drive, so we want Native Title PVCs to join up.
Ooh.
Because it, we're the voice, or we want to represent the voice of the Native Title community in at the national level. So stuff like PBCs, Native Title holders, need more resourcing and funding to carry out their functions.
Yep.
The economic model we have at the moment is you trade rights and land for resources. That shouldn't be happening. The federal government should be investing more in supporting these organisations.
Mm.
And then the other one, of course, is we're inviting, you know, your listeners, everybody, to participate in or engage in this process of co-designing an engagement process for the amendments or changes to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Protection Act.
Yep.
At the federal level.
Yeah, right.
And that's a big thing coming out of, you know, all across the country, our sacred sites, our cultural areas are under siege from development, incremental development.
Yeah.
And, you know, Juukan Gorge is probably the biggest example of that, but it happens every day in all our countries.
Yeah.
Important places are getting destroyed.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Juukan Gorge and I guess how the mob are feeling now, a couple of years after the destruction of that site. And I guess what we've seen is, I guess, the blame sharing and I guess the... you know, Rio Tinto and whatnot, Their stance on issues hasn't been that strong. What's it like over there now?
Well, the damage is done, so that hurt is still there. And, you know, that's never going to go away.
That's right.
Yeah. And there's no amount of platitudes or money or whatever can replace that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I want our audiences to understand out here. Not, our mob probably understand, but from non-Indigenous listeners, you know, once a sacred site is destroyed and gone, it's gone forever.
Mm.
You can't bring it back. You can't rebuild it. You know, and that loss is immense for the traditional owners, you know. So I just want people to really understand that time does not heal these wounds in this case.
No. And, you know, and that's part of the trauma that we all carry. You know, not only have our people been massacred, our languages have been massacred, our family connections, and also our country has been massacred. And each one of those is a compilation of trauma that builds on itself. So that's why Juukan Gorge resonated with every single Indigenous person in the country, is they go, oh my God, that, you know, it's happening there, it's so blatant, so obvious.
Yep.
By one of the biggest multinational corporations in the world, supported by the state of Western Australia.
Yeah, yes, it's not some sly farmer with a bulldozer ripping up a bit of land. It's a whole national, international corporation, you know, so...
Well, and that's it, yeah. I mean, the farmer with a bulldozer, he wouldn't know any different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They knew.
These guys know the difference. They had an agreement in place, and they tried to stop the people from talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about, just for our audience, a bit about your country and your culture?
Yeah, sure.
Your community? I just want people to know a bit about you, because you're a really interesting brother, you know. You're obviously highly intellectual and just very cultural, grounding your culture as well, and I just love that about our people. I'd just love to hear a bit about you and your cultural community, brother.
Yeah. Well, I feel myself really fortunate, really privileged. My mother and her parents effectively were nomads. They lived in the bush. Mm-hmm. They come out of the bush. My grandparents, probably middle-aged when they come out of the bush.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've just got goosebumps. I've just got chills a bit there.
Yeah.
Because you think, you know, colonisation, you know, it seems so long ago, but when you hear stories of our mob still walking out of the bush, you know.
It's real. Yeah. And that's the thing. So the frontier swept around Australia at a slow pace. And when it come to my part of the world, so Wiluna, Leonora, Laverton, Warburton, Jigalong, that's my part of the world.
Yep.
The frontier came through there in the 1920s, essentially. And so my grandparents came in contact probably through the 40s. And right through to me as a young boy in the 1970s, in Wiluna, I'm sitting in a classroom with kids who walked out of the bush in the 1970s or in the 1960s. And the last family that come out of the bush out there, there's two groups. One was at, known as the Pindaby Nine up at Lake Mackay.
Yep.
This last group came out there at Junjunjara. It's 600 to 800 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you know, I come from that background. And it might offend some people, but I'm fortunate in that my family never went through missions.
Uh-huh.
We never went through stolen generations or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so I had that opportunity to be directly connected back to old ways, the classical sort of culture, and then find my way through following education, because when I was a young fellow, I went down holiday work at the local shire. As a 14-year-old, I couldn't operate any machinery apart from a lawnmower. So they put me in charge of a lawnmower to mow the oval.
the AFL oval too.
Yeah.
Much bigger than the rugby league ovals out there, peoples.
Exactly, yeah. So I saw my future looking pretty bright and green. I thought, no, I better stay at school.
Yeah, I'm gonna become an academic. I'm gonna learn how to read and write properly and study. See you later, lawnmower.
Yeah, and I have an allergy to mowing grass.
Do you really? You're just pulling my leg.
Oh, I did at the time. I seem to cured myself of it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just stayed at school for as long as I can, and But what I see there, my foundation, I see the world through that traditional cultural lens first. Spirituality. Today we had a talk where the mob talking about sovereignty and treaties.
Yes.
And I missed it completely. I've read the Mabo decision many times, but Tony McAvoy raised it in the presentation today.
Yeah.
And it's in the Uluru Statement, which is spiritual sovereignty. And that's our thing, you know. We are spiritual people, we're cultural people, and we just got to connect back to that spirit and that culture and let that guide us. And that's how I interact, you know. I go and hang out with, you know, Wanjalas and people all over the country, but it comes back to the cultural core that's at the core of all of us.
Yes.
You know, we've all got that spirit as Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, and use that to guide us.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful here, and thanks for sharing that too, by the way.
Yeah.
Amazing story. I guess, can I get you to reflect on Mabo Day?
Yeah.
It's coming up, the 30th anniversary at the end of this week. And, you know, the Wick decision was monumental, and then it gave the pathway to native title and the Mabo decision. Can you reflect on what that decision meant for you and your country? And I guess, you know, where are we at now?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one. I'll start at my country and work back. So I'm on, because of box and dice and all that, we're on a number of different determinations in the desert country. The two main ones that I'm active in is the GWOL, which is over pastoral leases, and where we've got a compensation claim in the federal court at the moment, one of the first after Timber Creek. But it's all confidential and without prejudice, so I'm not allowed to talk about it, apart from say we've got it in and there's some interesting things going on there.
Yeah, right.
I've got another area that I come from, which is my grandparents' core homelands, is what we call the Mundaredi determination area. We have 24,000 square kilometres of exclusive possession of country. Only three mining tenements on it, and 1.5 roads. So basically our mob looked out of the bush, so we can go back to waterholes and, you know, and see the depression still in the ground where the old people camp.
Yeah.
That's still there, you know. There's some places where the fires have been, just the dirt covered over the fires, and old camps are still there. And
that's special. It's special. Yeah.
And see, the realisation for me when we got our determination, because what a determination does is it says the last 200 years, the last, in our case, the last 50 years or, you know, 80 years, doesn't exist. So a determination says that it's a recognition by the laws of Australia that we have continued to hold these rights and interests in land since time immemorial. And that goes, you know, there is a date to time immemorial, but I won't go into that, but it's before Waikoloa's come to Australia.
Yep.
And that's there's a lot of, you know, negativity about native title and all that, because there's divisions that are goes on, but these divisions are really communities and families renegotiating their positions.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way to look at it, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's not really terrible, because people need to be able to articulate and negotiate their positions. And if the tools that we have are, you know, abrupt and abrasive and all that sort of stuff, we see that all the time.
That's
how our mob do it. But we also have our conflict resolution mechanisms, which often we're not allowed to play out to full scope. But we do have these systems in place within our laws and customs too. So come back to Mabo decision. What Mabo did was he wanted recognition of his rights and interests on his land. And the court didn't actually find specifically for him, but it generalised for everyone. And the specific for him is something that we carve out as our own rights internally. But It's basically, and this is where Noel Pearson was one of the first commentators to identify this idea of the recognition space.
Uh-huh.
And the recognition space is where the English common law, which developed in England after 1066, yeah, so that's time immemorial is 1066.
Yeah, right.
Before that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So from 1066 up till today, we've had the common law emerge. And the common law allowed for rights and interests in land to be recognised that does not come from the Crown. And that's the most important thing about Mabo, is that Mabo said, hey, you can't continue to say that Australia is terra nullius.
Yes.
It's not an empty land. There are people here, and these people have rights and interests in that land that do not come from the Queen. Everyone else in this country, whether it's Aboriginal land rights land, freehold title, all of those, any of those titles that come under legislation,
yeah, under the Queen.
They're under the Queen. Our rights and interests do not come from the Queen.
Yeah, right.
So that's the most fundamental, most important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It is. I wouldn't say, I don't know if controversial is the right word for native title, but I think what the frustration is that I'm hearing, you know, on this show, is the amount of time it takes to get native title, and then the end result's not that great, you think, you know. But just the principle of having it. Well, actually, you know, because a lot of elders who start out as applicants might not see the end of the decision because it takes so long, you know.
Yeah.
And we saw this with Corky. Yeah. Mabo only found this the other day. I didn't realise he didn't live to see the decision get handed down, you know. So is there ways that we can sort of improve or streamline native title so it doesn't take 20 or 30 years?
Well, my example, I was a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young fellow when I started. And I was working for my elders.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we got to the end, all my elders had passed away.
Yeah, it's real sadness.
Yeah.
You know? Because I've been to a couple of these celebrations, I guess, of native titles, the land getting handed back and whatnot, but it's almost a sense of sadness because so many elders have been lost along the way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it took us, like with Chiwal, took us 25 years. So Mabo took 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that took us 25 years. There are still people in the court, so there's probably about 200... claims have to be determined across the country. And if anything, with the new government, let's get it done. Let's get all these claims determined in the next 5 years so people can move on with their lives. Because once you get it, life does change.
Yeah, right. Can you explain that change for me and for our audience?
Yeah. Well, see, I come from communities like Wiluna and a lot of the desert country out there. Murdu people, for instance. And in Wiluna is the best example. They now have one of the world's best examples of looking after endangered animals.
Yeah, right.
You know, in the world, best practice. Bilbies, you know, all these marsupials that are nearly extinct because our mob are now engaged and active in managing and protecting the country.
Yeah.
And bringing all those practices back into place. So it's just little simple things like that. In our Jewel community, we have what's known as our sustainability framework. So, unfortunately, we lose country to mining. We do get compensation for that. And what we then do is allocate any monies back to what we identify as our priorities. And it's against the sustainability framework.
Yep.
So it's into education, into funerals, into employment, into, you know, all these different things. And this is the big change that we all need to do, not only in native title, but everybody. When you're negotiating with government, make sure you get the money on the table. The resources there, and you control it.
Yep.
Because too long, they come into negotiations with us, and then they fund it.
Yeah, right.
And then they starve, turn the tap off.
Yeah.
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 So we've got to do a lot of work self-organising, identify what our priorities are, map that out, and then identify how we resource it. Human capital, money, all the stuff.
Well, this sort of
what the Native Title Council sort of does? Because I'm just sort of thinking, a lot of it, you know, if government goes into some communities who aren't well-resourced or experienced in Native Title and the laws surrounding it, which are very complex, it can be like, you know, taking candy from a baby.
It is.
And you put yourself in a bad position from the get-go.
Yeah.
Is there work being done to sort of, I guess, drop knowledge on communities to help them through the process?
Yeah, so we've got a PBC support sort of program that we're rolling out. Getting people just to sit down and talk, share ideas amongst each other. You know, that's how you learn. That's what summits like this are about.
Yep.
But it's also, so there's that, the learning, the, you know, getting yourself prepared. But there is a real issue here where the Australian government needs to invest in major resourcing, putting money back in so that we actually have the financial capabilities to be able to engage effectively. That's not happening. And the way the model is at the moment, the model that's developed in for PVCs, is they are forcing us to trade our rights and our native title to get resources. Often these monies are directed...
I nearly swore then. Lucky I didn't. The boss would ground me.
These resources are directed through charitable trusts and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So the money story is the most important thing that we need to get on top of and take back and control.
Mm.
Yeah.
It seems like this could be a whole series just on, you know, this to educate our mob on the title and, you know, the processes that everyone has to undertake. With the Albanese government coming into power, does that change anything with Native Title? In terms of, you know, everyone's talking about a voice of parliament, referendums, looking at treaty models, you know, as they've committed to a constitutional reform and including a treaty, the Albanese government. Does that change anything? Or is it a new playing field?
I think we're cautiously optimistic that it will change something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the minister's coming here tomorrow, I believe, to this summit. And hopefully, they must have made plans. They must have plans on what they're going to do, when they're going to do it, how they're going to do it. Ideally, what we'd be looking for is opportunities to have a mature conversation with government. As equals, as First Nations peoples, and to be able to take back control of our lives, which in the last, during the Howard years, even in the Rudd and Gillard years, we lost control of our lives.
They were too busy fighting each other.
They kept the intervention going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Let's not forget that. I was up in the Northern Territory then. It was a very, very sad and, you know, depressing time.
Yeah.
Like follows it was.
We lost bilingual education.
Yeah.
What a crime against humanity that is.
Just on that, wouldn't it be great to bring that back?
Yeah.
I was talking with some friends the other day there. We're just saying, like, even in my community out at Moree, because a lot of primary schools always had a foreign language that they taught. They would teach Japanese or Indonesian or French or Spanish or German.
Mm.
But there was never any Aboriginal languages getting taught. Mm. I'm just talking about New South Wales. But wouldn't it be great if... So you're on your country and everyone in that school has to learn their local language.
Mm.
So you get, you know, white fellas, Chinese mob, Fijian...
They want to learn our language.
And say Yama on the street to me, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I find that a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
When they start, you know, Yama Danny, I was like, Yama, my people. You know, I love it.
Yeah.
You know, is there a chance to bring back bilingual education?
Well, how many of our mob are trained educators?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nearly everybody who's got a PhD in the early days came through as an educator.
Yeah.
So we just need the government to set the tone.
Yeah.
Because it was John Howard who took away bilingual education out of the Northern Territory.
Mm.
That's destroyed a generation of young Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory who basically lost track of their education.
Mm.
It's a beautiful thing. I'm bilingual. I can read and write in my language and English. But I sat in a meeting once with an old man from, you know, Pidginjatta communities, And he pulled out a notebook and he started taking notes. We were having this meeting. And I looked over at what he was, like, good eyes then. Looked over at what he was writing and it was all in Pidginjada.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And he was hearing, you know, the English talking up there and he was writing. And he was an old man.
It's sort of good in a way too, because if someone is looking over your notes like you were peeking, they wouldn't be able to read it or understand what you're writing down.
Exactly. Yeah.
It could be a, you know, a bit of a...
See, that's our right.
Yeah.
That's one of our rights. You should be able to talk in your language. You should be able to read and write in your language. And hopefully, you know, our minister will be able to... And this is why my thing about the First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance, while it's about protecting our country from vandalism, from development, we've got to go beyond that. We've got to get up to UNESCO level.
Yeah.
We have, in our culture, we have some of the... icons of intangible heritage, our song lines, our dreaming tracks, our languages, our knowledge. These are iconic level intangible cultural heritage. They need to be protected. And that's the level of discourse I would hope to see emerge with this new government. You know, we're all optimistic and all that sort of stuff.
Well, bushy-eyed and more smiley and happy, but see what happens in 3 years.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's nothing stopping us from doing it.
Yeah, that's right. Can you tell us about the work you're doing with the Protection Alliance? Because, and obviously it's probably more resolute, what's happened with Juukan Gorge, you know. But as you said before, too, we know this happens every day and around the country, you know.
Yeah.
That was a massive thing that hurt us all, but there's still so much work to be done in this area, you know.
Yeah, so technically what we're doing is we've negotiated a co-design agreement with the previous government, with the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment, and one of the first things you do, there's an agreement and you get the resourcing. And now we're setting out a process of engagement. And what we're doing is going around calling on mobs to come onto our website, so culturalheritage.org.au, and get in contact with our secretariat. We're starting at the level of engagement with the representative type organisations. But we want to hear stories. And we want to draw these themes out so that when we go back to government and we design an approach that we go back to government on, we want to bring in standards at a national level for cultural heritage protection. And my particular bugbear is it shouldn't all be just about places and impacts and vandalism and all that.
Yep.
We should also have the intangible cultural heritage, which are all the language, the arts, the dance, the family trees, all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But in particular, though, this process is about reforming the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Protection Act, which was introduced in 1984. And so it's a co-design process of getting our mob to give input into how this legislation should be reformed.
Oh.
Yeah.
I never really understood the power of cultural heritage and the legislation around it until I lived in Jabiru. And we're using it up there, and, you know, we're doing cultural mapping all around Kakadu or Gagaju. Shout out Tash Naji, she's around here somewhere today. But they use cultural heritage as a way to protect country. So stopping, you know, mining companies, stopping uranium mining and uranium exploration, things like that. So it's a real tool, sort of a real blanket of protection. Cultural heritage. Is that right in saying so?
It's our business. It's our strength. And so we got probably three platforms of strength. One is rights itself, spiritual sovereignty, cultural heritage. And we make that our business and we push that back into the mainstream and we define it. And that's what, if you go cultural landscape mapping, the white fellows will knock it down into a science and they'll particularise it and all that sort of stuff. But we go back to our core values. Our core values are about relationships, whether it's between us as people, whether it's between us as people in the spirit world, or us and the physical world, animals, plants, landscape and all of that. So that's cultural mapping in its true form.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's part of that spiritual sovereignty as well. Yeah.
In terms of natural disasters, I mean, we focus a lot on, you know, protecting ourselves from mining companies and the likes. But in terms of natural disasters, are we, you know, we've gone through, on the East Coast here, we've gone through floods, you know, crazy floods. Before that, we had bushfires. Mm. Before that, we had drought. We had COVID sprinkled all in between it. Is there sort of talk, and I know Victor Stephenson was, who wrote the book, Fire Sticks, about Indigenous fire management. Is that something that you're working on as well?
Probably not working on at a structural level.
Yep.
It is something that PBCs do, and people like Victor and others work with native title holders mob on the ground on the country. My contribution would be to say that you go back to our culture, our history, our oral histories. Mm-hmm. We've been through all the big climate change events. So our mob lived out between Tasmania and Victoria in the Bass Strait. Yep. There's a lake out there under the ocean.
Yeah, right.
People lived there.
Hey, wow.
Between New Guinea and Australia. Ooh. The Arafura Sea was once the Arafura Plains. Our mob lived there. They've still got stories about that country.
Yeah, wow.
So in our culture and our tradition, we actually have that knowledge. We have the knowledge of these major climatic events that occurred. And we have a bit of comfort in that we survived it. We maintained our culture for 60,000 years in that space. So if anybody want to survive this global turmoil, come back and talk to us and we'll show you how to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Simple as that.
Our hand is always open.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And what's the future looking like? You're obviously very busy. You're wearing a couple of different hats. Over the next couple of years, what's your sort of main priorities for the work that you're doing? And then I guess on a personal level, what's some of the personal things that you'd like to achieve?
Well, I'm...
And are you going to run for politics again?
No, not going back to politics. And that's one of the things I'm really happy about, is in the position I'm in at the moment and being able to talk and motivate and inspire others, we can make massive changes and differences without needing to go into Parliament and get beholden to those structures,
yes,
beholden to the donors, all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So, yeah, so, I mean, I don't rule it out for other people to do it, but I'm quite happy not to be a politician. And I suppose in my personal life I'm looking at getting a bit more effective in my business dealings and stuff like that. So there's a few things in train there. I've got a company called Gilgi, which we're becoming a communications technology type company. So that's one thing. But I'm also still, at this stage, working with the PBC mob, getting things set up.
Yeah, it's much better work.
Yeah, but core thing is... there's another philosophy I got, which I'll share with the listeners, and our mob will connect on it straight away. There's a fellow called Louis Riel, who was a Métis leader in Canada.
Yep.
He was the founder of the province of Manitoba.
Yeah, right.
He led two wars against the Canadians, or the British. Eventually, he was captured and executed. But one of his sayings that I draw inspiration from is, he said, "My people will go to sleep for 100 years, and it will be the arts that will bring their spirit back."
Wow, really?
Yeah. And so, we got that.
Yeah.
We got the arts.
Yeah.
And so I'm involved in a big project at the moment called Reclaim the Void, which is basically taking one of my mother's dot paintings, working with anybody and everybody who wants to make a rug. We're using recycled fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a technique which you'll find if you go to reclaimthevoid.com.au. There's a video there that shows you how to make these rugs. And we're going to stitch it all together into a big dot painting and put it over a mining pit.
Can you ring me and let me know when you do this? Because I want to get you back on the show. And that just sounds amazing. And it goes back to that, the art.
Yeah.
The arts bring it all back to life, right?
It is, yeah. The arts.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a beautiful session here, the opening session with, what's his name? Lyndon Davies.
Yeah, Lyndon Davies, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Brilliant art. What it speaks to, I mean, I'm sitting in the audience going, yep, he's the sound, voice, that's where magic is.
Yeah.
And he's working with magic through art.
Yeah, there's some great artists here, actually. I'm going to try and catch up with them all. But, I love our artists, and I just love the artistic community, because I guess it's, in a sense, it's all who we are.
Yeah.
You know?
It is, yeah.
Kato, thanks so much for joining us on Let's Talk today.
No worries.
You're a great brother, a great man. I've always had a lot of respect for you. It's really exciting to see the work that you do for your community and for our mob over the next couple of years.
One thing I will say, you asked what for the future is, I want to encourage young people to step up, but do it in a cultural way. So don't get caught up in the Wajibala mindset. Yeah, so listen to your elders. Yeah, they might not always make sense, but they got that experience.
Yeah.
That's something I had to learn when I was a young bloke, you know. Oh, they're going too slow or something like that, but over time, you get to a point, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of our strengths. That's a really, you know, fundamental thing. That's the conversation we're having here, is that we're taking this intergenerational, it's not so much a struggle, it's a project that we're working on to reclaim our land, our culture, our spirit and our people, and do it in a way that's respectful, and that adds value to, the human experience.
Yeah, stand in your culture. Don't stand against it, you know. Don't stand up for TikTok or stand in that culture, you know, or Facebook or whatever. Be true to yourselves, young black people out there. Kato, thanks again, brother.
Valia, you all.
Valia, my people. Kato Muir, great man. Check him out. If you Google his name, you can see the great work that he does. And then get involved in some of his projects. Sounds great. Thanks, Kato.
Valia, you all.
You've been listening to Let's Talk Murray Country.